just now and is, and you've probably all known it, as an idea. If, having attained to this sense of light and life and power, inexhaustible, identical with oneself, which doesn't exist anymore, if the yogi can keep the mind concentrated for a sufficient period of time upon this interior spirit, and if he can obtain, yes, I should say, if he can obtain freedom from interruption, then he sinks into the depths of the interior source and becomes absorbed, dissolved therein. He's then in yoga, union. He's vanished. He's merged, dissolved, like light in light. Water in water, space in space. Then an utter tranquility stills the mind, which is no longer being used. Consciousness being supramental. And there, in a state that can't be described, can't be communicated, in bliss, he remains. And that is the ideal of yoga. As I have said, and as we often repeat, it is important then to return very gradually to full brain consciousness, to come out of the infinite withinness of the cube, gradually back into the three-dimensional limitations, into the mind, the emotions, and then emerge gradually into bodily life, preserving the flavor of the inner experience, so that in a sense it's always there. It's always there. As if the doorway doesn't wholly close, and consciousness can, sometimes does of its own accord, slip back into the one supreme splendor. Forever at one therewith. That's yoga. That's the successful yogi. Here are some further references and descriptions. Such illumination is gained by meditating on those utterances or actions that are directly poured out from the inner region, undimmed by intellect or imagination. The overflow of genius, you know, which comes from this interior inner world. And when you're in the presence of that, in any of the arts, including literature, you're close to the gateway leading to the source of that illumination. Then dwell on those motifs, themes, lines of a poem, utterances of truth, descriptions of mystics, until they become one's own. Then one gets an insight into the nature of one's own being. And this insight finally puts a stop to all doubts, all hankerings and cravings which hitherto upset one's mental tranquility. They die away. And the tendency is continually to be aware in the inexhaustible light and life. Then, even the sense of individuality begins to fade, lose its force, its meaning. Individuality becomes loosened somehow from its tightening grip and melts away into, I oughtn't to say anything, melts away into something indescribable. And it's this melting away which is the great procedure which naturally occurs. A complete release is gained, an absolute rest. It's like the end of a journey, the feeling, at last I've arrived. All is over. A marvelous rest, of course. Jacob Burma is one such source, I feel. Listen to him. From Aurora, which I do recommend. He says, he's in this strange state. Although he was a humble cobbler, as you know, he was a reborn seer, yogi, mystic. And he describes his experiences. Listen. I saw and comprehended the being of all beings, the abyss and the abyss, I saw the original and primal existence of this world and all creatures. Within myself, I perceived creation entire, means total, and its order of movement. I saw first the divine world of the angels and of paradise, he says. Second, the darkened world. And third, this world around us, visible and tangible, as an issue and expression of the inner, eternal, hidden worlds. Moreover, I comprehended the whole being and reason of good and evil. He describes his search. I resolved, he says, not to cease asking for God's love and mercy until his blessing should descend upon me. Then did the Spirit break through. Then were the clouds broken away, and the illumination of the Spirit was shed upon me. Thus in my zeal, says Burma, I beat down the portals of hell and hazarded my whole life until suddenly my spirit burst through the last barriers. He says, and I stood in the presence, apprehending the very essence of divine being. He closes this particular passage. I was there, enfolded with love. Do get and read Aurora. Also, friends, all the Upanishads, they are full of this. The Logos itself is revealing itself in this immortal literature. In heaven there is no fear at all. Death is not there, nor in that place does the thought of growing old make one tremble. There, free from hunger and from thirst, far from the reach of sorrow, all rejoice and are glad. Egoic consciousness. Last one before we break, because it leads into our next phase, which we'll be meditating together. The man who had learned that the self is separate from the body, from the senses and the mind, and has fully known the Lord, the soul of truth, the subtle principle, such a man verily attains and is exceeding glad because he has found the source and dwelling place of all felicity, happiness. And so on, friends, these immortal books go on and on, giving us brief sentences, you see, reading which to ourselves, pausing to dwell on them. Take one through into this inner world of light and life and love immortal. And Brahmic bliss, as it is called. Now, shall we? shall we break? Is it possible, by meditation, to strengthen the will, to control, in order to control better, the mind, to purify the emotions, and also the physical elemental, as in sexuality? It seems sometimes that this elemental is stronger than the will. A big and very important question, which, as you've heard, has four parts. How, by meditation, to strengthen the will? How, by strengthening the will, can one better control the mind? Three, how to purify the emotions? Four, how to purify the physical elemental? And then there follows the statement that sometimes this physical elemental seems stronger than the inner will. The very, very big problem. And I think a fairly general one. However, I will offer some comments. In the beginning, I would like to say this, that success in all this depends upon full commitment to the task. Half-hearted endeavors will only lead to disappointment and failure. So this task must become a primary project, fully accepted as such, fully implemented, in handling these four vehicles of ours, to which St. Francis gave the general title, Brother Ass. One must wholly commit oneself to the task until it is completed. Here are some suggestions. First, try and function as an ego all the time, so that you are controlling from within and from above, and not as a person fighting a person. The more we can act, live, work as an ego, using this instrument, the more efficient, more effective we will be. One advantage of regular practice of yoga: one comes to know oneself increasingly, not as the body, but as the true spiritual soul. Now let us take the four parts of the question, shall we? How, by meditation, to strengthen the will? We are told in one of these books of spiritual counsel to make of oneself the subject of grave experiment. Experiment, then, upon the will. How can one? Well, by meditating upon the Atma, which is a manifestation in man of the cosmic will. meditate upon Atman, or the pure spirit essence of one's nature, until one is identified with it and can call upon it when required as a kind of dominating power which brooks no interference and whose decisions are final. This may be helped by identifying oneself with that will. I am that am I. Thus visualizing the omnipotence of the will over the personality. Become a veritable incarnation of the divine will. And if anything or anybody gets in the way, so much the worse for them. That's the attitude. This is achieved by meditation on will. Second, by strengthening the will, can one better control the mind? The Gita says, harder to control than the wind. Now again, suggest only, always have mentally available, permissible, and preferably inspiring kinds of thought. Which can be immediately dwelt upon when the difficulty arises. Establish a technique of the mental switch so that when mental trouble comes, switch at once to the permissible thought. For example, the great masters of the wisdom, the Lord Christ, the Lady Mary, the great saints, the great heroes and their heroic acts, or any other suitable, elevating and happiness-giving thinking of a beneficent character, I would suggest. And then when this mind begins to get troublesome, switch at once to something pleasant, uplifting. Don't fight the difficulty. Ignore it. Let it die of inanition. Concentrate upon the opposite virtue. Remember what the disciples did when the storm arose and the whole safety of the ship was endangered. What did they do? A very strange and apparently incongruous thing. They forsook the task of navigation and awoke the sleeping passenger. The divine. He, the Lord, confronted the storm and said, "Peace, be still." And it was so. Well, the sleeping passenger is within us because this is an interior story, applying very much to our problem. So always have a happiness-giving, inspiring thought. Ever available, turn to it at once. Don't feed the difficult thought by thinking of it. It lives on that. Starve it out. Now here we must remember that the great difficulty of the mind in this sense is its image-making faculty. And those of us who have these difficulties need sternly to resist undesirable image forming. Why? Well, if image forming isn't stopped, the emotions will be stirred up and respond, perhaps with powerful urges of desire. And then the physical body may respond with intense organic craving. So, you see, control of the image-making faculty is important. The third problem was how to purify the emotions. The third part of the one problem. Well, I repeat, a very real decision must be taken. Never more voluntarily to indulge in impure imaginings under any conditions whatever. This must be as an irrevocable resolve continually strengthened by the will. It seems only common sense to find it useless to try to purify the emotions by meditation if, when one is not meditating, impure thoughts are allowed. Impure feeling is indulged in. The one negates the other. I am aware that I am giving what in English is called a counsel of perfection. A phrase which means advice which is almost too difficult to accept. A counsel of perfection. We're imperfect beings. But I believe this to be the ideal and the way. I repeat, always have an inspiring thought with which instantly to replace undesired thought and feeling. The masters, the work, the salvation of humanity. Contrary action to the evils in the world. Something constructive for the benefit of the world. So that you build, constructively, positively. And it's a joy to go there. Have a school, which is the perfect school. Build it, plan it, see how it works, improve it. And immediately turn to that when trouble comes. Now the fourth part was how to purify the physical element, especially from sexuality. Well, here, forgive the repetition, the decision I think must be taken and adhered to, that sexuality shall no longer be permitted as part of the conduct of life. I should think it of little value to try by meditation, as you suggest, to cure oneself of self-indulgence and sensuality by meditation half an hour every day, if for the rest of the day the opposite is pursued. That's what I mean by total commitment to the project. This is quite essential, I think, since otherwise the indulgence negates the decision, and continued failure will be the result. Or, in simple terms, half-hearted measures in this problem will never succeed. Now, I'm dealing in broad outlines with a very subtle and complicated problem, which is all I have time and even knowledge to present. Now, may I make a suggestion about all this of a more tangible and concrete form? I think one needs, who is in this difficulty, to set aside at least a quarter of an hour of every day, preferably in the morning, first 5 minutes, concentrating upon will, victory, heroism, white purity. What a man thinks on, he becomes, remember. Second 5 minutes. Meditate upon absolute purity. Oneself as stainless, white, power in purity. Third 5 minutes. Make a powerful resolve that throughout the day, willpower shall grow greater and greater, and shall dominate mind, emotion, and bodily appetite. Irrevocable resolve. 5 minutes of each of those each day. Then repeat briefly, particularly the resolve, a few times during the day. Noon is a good time. And also, of course, whenever the difficulty arises or the temptation comes, repeat the meditation. Then, before going to sleep at night, determine that the physical elemental shall be entirely subject to the egoic will. And that on waking next morning, the inner will shall rule mind, emotion, and body. This is very effective. It seems to function and operate during sleep, this strong order to the personality and, as you put it, the physical element. Finally, I repeat, it is essential to control the image-forming faculty and power of the mind. Otherwise, failure can result. Imaginations can defeat the strongest will. Perhaps not. Please expound. The theosophical idea of the sixth sub-race of the fifth root race. First, just a word or two about the idea of races on Earth. A world period, according to theosophy, consists of the occupation of a planet by man through seven racial periods. These are called root races. Each of them is subdivided into seven overlapping sub-races. This septenary principle is found to rule in occult and ethnology. We are in the fifth root race. Period. Now, though the fourth root race preponderates in numbers on Earth, difficult to teach because the various theosophical books make first the sub-race which wasn't the first one in time. Why? Well, because the Indian sub-race was formed by a descent of the root stock from Central Asia into India. The root Aryan stock, from which all the others developed, descended into India, and this is therefore called the first sub-race. Before that, India had been inhabited by varying Lemurian and Atlantean races. Then the second sub-race is called the Arabian. It spread westwards and extended its dominion over Arabia, Africa, Mesopotamia, and the whole of Persia. The third, or Persian sub-race, dominated the whole of Western Asia, including Asia Minor, Cyprus, Rhodes, and Crete. The fourth sub-race is called the Celtic. Started from Central Asia, passed north of Persia, made a home in the Caucasus, and then developed and spread westwards along the southern Mediterranean, Spain, and branches came up into Ireland, Wales, and Scotland, all of whom are referred to as Celts, K-E-L-T-S. Then the fifth sub-race, called the Teutonic, after passing through Persia, bit the Celtic race, and settling in the Caucasus, moved northwest into Central Europe, Krakow, Poland, and then spread throughout almost all Europe. That brings us up to date. That's where we are now. Very much in outline, since that is not your question, but it's the framework for a possible answer. Now, you ask about the sixth sub-race. It's said in certain philosophical books, none of which are Bibles, in the sense of infallibility, said as the sixth root race will start about 2600 AD and reach its height about 50,000 AD. Now, I mention it because the qualities and type of this race are already beginning to be foreshadowed in the sixth sub-race of the Aryan. There is this peculiar numerical relationship which the student finds very interesting. The fifth root race was formed largely out of the fifth sub-race of the Atlantean. And the sixth root race will be formed largely out of the sixth sub-race of our own. Interesting. What will these people be like? Your question. Well, it's said to be being foreshadowed in various countries, but not in them alone, all over the world, really. I should imagine very much here, in Switzerland, and surroundings. But it's in North America, South Africa, Australia and New Zealand, where emigrations arrived and came to almost virgin land, sparsely populated, and under those magnetic, climatic and other conditions of pioneering and building civilizations, they, each of them, developed special qualities. For example, it is assumed that extrasensory perception will, in the sixth sub-race, and still more in the sixth root race, will be developed. There will be a natural psychic sensitivity, conscious clairvoyance, and natural intuitiveness. You find that already in many of these countries, notably in America. So the powers of the Christ consciousness in the sixth root race will begin to function fully, and the realization of oneness, a growing and deepening compassion, a natural loving ministration to others, and our first object, of which we're trying to form a nucleus of the Theosophical Society, will in due course have become perfectly natural, the brotherhood of man. Grant me a few minutes to find my place to advance a few more thoughts. Thanks as follows. That's what I was looking for. Secret Doctrine, Volume 3, pages 440 to 444. Adyar edition. And even now, 1888, when she was writing, even now, under our very eyes, the new race and races are preparing to be formed. And it is in America that the transformation will take place and has already silently commenced. The Americans of the United States have already become a race apart. They are the germs of the sixth subrace. And in some few hundred years more, will most decidedly be the pioneers of that race. Then they will launch into the seventh subrace, said to be in South America, by the by, until in consequence of cataclysms, parts of Europe and America will be destroyed. And the sixth root race will have appeared on the stage of our round. Well, what will these six sub-race people be like, foreshadowing the six root race? I've attempted, for my own studies, a kind of composite image of them. What will they be like? Well, since it's my privilege to travel amongst them all the time, apparently something like this. Physically, the new race young man intends to be tall and wiry, somewhat slender of form. The Australians are becoming taller and heavier, and growing faster than they did 20 years ago. So also the girls. They're taller and a little heavier. In New Zealand, the bill's a little shorter, but growing. The facial features, when they do show, are everywhere much the same. This is what one tends to look for. They are finely modeled and straight. The nose tends to be long, and in one variant the chin is pointed. The forehead broad, making the face somewhat triangular. They're also, more than that I think, on the face of these wonderful young men and women and elders of the future, there's a certain eagerness, vivid alertness, stamped upon the whole face. They're wonderfully alive. So it looks as if the New Age man, in answer to your question, will be vital, handsome, chivalrous, strong, courageous, yet kindly. Well, we can begin to forecast the psychological characteristics, a little, by studying advanced people in all through the world, and especially in these parts of the world. Apparently, the very essence of all action will be the union of many to achieve a single object. Not the dominance of one who compels the other to his will. They will want to advance together in freedom to a goal that all realize as desirable of attainment. And this ultimately will be the method. And so we might say, I think, that this tendency to unity of action is one of the signs of racial evolution out of dependence upon mental processes only into the exercise of the intuitive function. recognizing that we're all one, one objective, the welfare of humanity, our nation, our state, our city, our community, and we work together for that. There's been rather a nice phrase in English for this. What is it? A hunger for wholeness. W-H-O-L-E-N-E-W-S. A hunger for wholeness. And I think it must culminate in a complete will to world unity, realizable in the time ahead. This, of course, will be due to the fact that the subtler consciousness of the buddhic and higher mental bodies will begin to be more fully developed and so more fully expressive in the personal nature. So, finally, one might presume to try and understand if a person is or is not expressing six sub-rate qualities. One may look for a growing intuitiveness, a capacity to lead by love, sympathy, mutual comprehension, to see in freedom a veritable religion. We're seeing it in the world today now. However, one might wish it were going along more constructive channels, but apparently something must be broken down first. So freedom will probably be found to be a veritable religion, yet not freedom from responsibility. And in conclusion, according to my own studies of theosophy, the destiny of mankind is incomparable. And its fulfillment depends upon the will of each and every one of us voluntarily to collaborate in this transcendental task of the forward march of the whole of humanity into a state in which the Christ consciousness will be the dominating factor in all action, at all levels, and in all the departments of national and civic activity. So you see, apparently the ideal is not a universalized set of conditions and a uniformity of human personality, of course not. But full individual development by each, but with readiness to combine, to cooperate in great causes for human happiness and progress. That briefly is the best I can do for you in answer to that question. Changes our line of thought. It's like this. It concerns prayer. How would you define, the question, how would you define a truly theosophical idea of prayers of petition? Prayers for personal guidance, health, healing, and the improvement of one's own present situation when distressing. Again, every theosophist is free to form and follow their own idea. For example, a purely impersonal and philosophic approach presumably would be that the supreme deity, the Sura Logos, if you like, is already pouring out beneficent power in full abundance. And therefore the problem is not one of supply, but of receptivity. I'm taking a cold point of view on purpose first. Again, I suppose some students would say that if one accepts the law of karma, then the individual alone is responsible for his or her conditions, and theoretically also for the improvement of their lot, their way, as, for example, by loving service. But whilst acknowledging and recognizing that I am one theosophist who still believes in personal prayer and that it is permissible, true, and can be very helpful to take one's problems and lay them before or at the feet of someone far greater than oneself. In fact, I think it's a wonderful thing to believe that there are such beings to whom one can go in thought and prayer, from whom we may be assured of understanding and guidance, intellectual and even physical. Now, I suppose that these sort of prayers would always be to an intermediary between the Sura Logos and the petitioner. So this would include, wouldn't it, for us who are Christians, with the exception of Nicola, who are Christians, we would think of our Lord Christ, or we would go to Our Lady, or the World Mother, or we would go to one of the saints, or some great person, other great person, whom we believe to be channels for divine healing grace. And lay our problems before them and pray definitely for help and guidance, particularly when the situation is unbearable and apparently irremediable. This exists, remember, in human lives. And then again, the very thought of God and higher beings is beneficial by itself. Why? Well, because it attunes the mind and the heart and the brain to spiritual beings and so to spiritual worlds. And this kind of prayer, I think, can be a form of yoga, a permissible and helpful form of yoga, as I ventured to suggest earlier in our studies. I remember an experience I had once, which is not concerning myself, though I found myself in need, but in an old cathedral in the old city of Puerto Rico, of San Juan, Puerto Rico. We were meditating there, Sandra and I and some friends, and I saw two poor-looking men, obviously in terrible trouble and grief and despair. One was weeping, full-grown men, and they had come and knelt before the shrine of Our Lady. I was touched, of course, by seeing such grief, human need, and by the fact that they would come to Our Lady. And as I watched, I thought I saw a wonderful outpouring of grace and love from the shrine and from the statue of Our Lady. It was a very beautiful one. And this outpouring enfolded the two men and seemed to interpenetrate their auras and even bodies until they were really within the heart of the love of Our Lady. And this was a very real experience to which I could perhaps but add others. So I've come to believe in response to such appeals. And I think that Christianity, like other religions, is especially beautiful and helpful to millions of people on account of its provision of such opportunities for intercession to greater beings. And these beings, one may assume, not dogmatizing, but I think, are ever available to all.